Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in 2012, there were fewer murders in New York City than in any year since 1963. Were you aware of that latest record on the murder rate in the city? Randall Contreras' new book, The Stick-Up Kids, Race, Drugs, Violence, and the American Dream, takes us back to the beginning of the 20-year decline in violent crime and the streets of the South Bronx to tell a radically different story than the statistics do for today. After a failed stint as a drug dealer, he became a researcher at CUNY after he had turned his life around and gotten an education. Armed with a tape recorder, he went to the bodegas and street corners of his neighborhood's drug trade and got friends and peers to describe on tape a world of violent robberies that always went unreported because the victims were themselves drug dealers. Now an assistant professor of sociology at California State University Fullerton, he is here to tell the story. Welcome to the show, Randall Contreras. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
So it's the early 90s. Crack's impact is declining as people see the damage it does. Aspiring criminals start to realize that the only way to strike it rich is to rob other drug dealers, you say. What made you want to tell their stories? Who are these stick-up kids for you?
Well, these stick-up kids are actually some of the friends I had grown up with in the South Bronx when I was coming of age in the South Bronx during the mid-1980s. And as you mentioned, I actually attempted to become a drug dealer. But after many failed attempts, I decided to sort of pursue my second option, which was school. And, you know, after going to school, I became really interested in immigration, urban crime, and in doing field research. I came back to my neighborhood, and I attended City College of the City University of New York. And then later on, I attended the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And while I went to I attended graduate school, I actually still hung out with my friends. We, you know, hung out in bars. We hung out on street corners. I would drop by, visit their homes. And then one thing I realized as I was hanging out with them is that they no longer sold drugs anymore because, like you mentioned, they weren't making as much money anymore through selling crack or cocaine. So then they became violent drug robbers. And so these men were actually my friends that I had grown up with, and I sort of just used them as the basis of my research. And one night, one of them, I asked one of them if I could do research on this stick-up kids phenomenon. And they actually agreed, and they took me to this block about three blocks away from where we lived. And I actually saw for the first time a drug robbery in action, or the planning of a drug robbery in action, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and these Dominican men who were playing these stick-ups, they were drinking heavily, they were doing drugs heavily. And that's the first time I really sort of got the insider's look.
One interesting thing in your book is that you write that the broken windows policing method, famously adopted by the Giuliani administration and maintained under Bloomberg, that is, stop the small crimes, arrest people for breaking windows, for turnstile jumping, for marijuana possession, stop the small crimes and the big ones will follow. But you say it's a myth because some of your subjects thought it was very real at the time and almost all of them end up in jail at one point or another, but that this didn't change the criminal culture. Is that your take?
Well, my take on that is that street crime, New York City street crime, had actually been declining before Giuliani entered office. It actually started declining under David Dinkins' watch. And then we also see that crime declined across the nation, across cities that had different styles of policing, and they all experienced crime drops during the 1990s. And also,
A lot of things were going on around the country in a lot of cities that were get tough measures. Police buildups, like happened under Dinkins, adding a lot more cops, longer sentences for violent criminals and sometimes nonviolent criminals, like with the Rockefeller drug laws. Were these the kinds of things that nationwide, as in New York, made a difference?
Well, I would actually argue that we have to start taking the community into account. And lots of residents in New York City, I mean, they wanted to put an end to the crack scourge, right? You know, they saw lots of their friends, lots of their family members lots of their neighbors suffer because of the rising crack market or destructive mm-hmm. nature of the crack market. So they actually took a stand. They started forming community organizations. They started lobbying for more police involvement in their communities. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's really important that a lot of people don't realize is that you have this new generation of urban youth that sought liberation from their crack market, right? Because, again, a lot of them saw what had happened to family and friends, and they pretty much took a stand as well. And they started stigmatizing crack users and the crack market, and they actually started using, during that period, new drugs of choice, right? They started, rather than using crack or cocaine, they started using marijuana. They started drinking malt liquor beers, right, these mm-hmm. 40-ounce bottles of beer. And so, you know, the community sort of turned things around as well.
People see reality in front of their noses and respond mm-hmm. to it. Randall Contreras, my guest, his book, The Stick Up Kids, Race, Drugs, Violence, and the American Dream. John Jay College released a survey of retired police officers this summer that showed more than 80% had downgraded felonies or otherwise fudged crime reports during the Bloomberg era, according to them, juking the stats, they call it. Did you see evidence of that in the 90s?
Well, I mostly focused on the field research that I did during that period, but I tend to focus on shifting drug markets, community empowerment, and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't really speak to whether okay. or not they were fudging statistics.
The advanced copy of your book has a photo of you as a teenager with what looks like an assault rifle, maybe a Bushmaster AR-15 on the cover. What gun was that, and what's the story behind your relationship with that gun?
Well, it's actually an advanced shotgun. And that photo was taken during the time when I was aspiring to be a crack dealer, and I sort of got caught up and sort of wanting to experience high material consumption, sort of experience the glamour of the crack trade, right? Because, I mean, during that period, during the late 1980s, early 1990s, like my friends, I really didn't see going to school as the route to success, right? Because a lot of the neighborhood residents or the people in my neighborhood who worked legally, and most of them did, they would have these low-wage jobs. They really didn't earn that much money. And they were just getting by. They were, like, seriously struggling. So, like my friends, you know, I thought the crack market was the only way out, because the people that I did see that were successful in my neighborhood were the young Puerto Rican and Dominican drug dealers. I mean, they're the ones that had the fancy cars. They're the ones that a lot of the women were attracted to, right? They're the ones that had the expensive clothes. I mean, they're the ones that, for me, had achieved the American dream. And so I started hanging out more with drug dealers, and that's the story behind taking a photo with that gun.
In fact, your book is also a story about Dominican immigrants and the process of assimilation. Part of what you criticize is American ideas about capitalism and materialism that they internalize, but your subjects' own experiences sometimes contradict their anything-for-a-buck ideas. For example, that section of the book where the characters are dealing drugs in Georgia, and it turns out they love the simple rural life there. It's the happiest times of their lives when they look back on it. Then they come back to New York to chase a big score. It's hard to fathom, in a way. Is that wealth imperative so strong that it overrides personal identity, even happiness?
Well, I mean, I think to a large degree, they're very well integrated into mainstream American culture. And so part of their identity comes from high material consumption, comes from living the high life. I mean, because when you look at, let's say, television ads, right? You know, we have, you know, they sort of try to convince us to purchase these high-end products, right? So I don't think criminals or people who commit crimes are necessarily not a part of this larger culture, right, this consumption culture that we have. So mm-hmm. they wanted to participate in the high life. You know, they wanted to earn the big money. I mean, they wanted to sort of emulate the lifestyle of the rich and famous.
How do you explain then? Why do you think that violent crime has continued to go down so dramatically in New York City as inequality has increased and even spiked over the last decade? Have you given that any thought?
Well, I would argue, given the research that I've come across, a lot of it has to do with how there's no real major drug epidemic. in major cities across the country.
Right.
I mean, the shrinking of right now, the shrinking of the crack market shrunk, you know, criminal opportunities, which would have led to more violence on the street, right? Because a lot of the violence that's drug related happens because of turf disputes, encroachment on other people's territory, dealing with individuals within drug organizations who violate rules and so forth. So a lot of it has to do with systemic violence, as Goldstein calls it.
Have you thought about the gun debate we're having in this country? Like, did the assault weapons ban in 1994, for instance, that was in effect for a while after that, have any impact on the South Bronx?
Yeah, I've thought about this, and I think I don't know about whether the weapons ban had an effect on the South Bronx drug market in that sense, but I do know that the availability of guns sort of worsened the type of violence that occurred within the drug market, because now, you know, they have a gun in hand, which they can sort of use to do violence, right, to take care of their business or private matters related to the drug market. But I would argue that a lot of it has to do with, or the decline in violence has to do with the decline in the drug market, or, you know, the disappearance of the crack era, mm-hmm. or the crack market.
And with your background, do you think we're having the right conversation about guns after Newtown? Because one of the conversations we've been having on this show is how invisible certain violent crime is. You know, a rare event at a suburban school gets attention, but daily violence in the Bronx is treated as ho-hum. And I think President Obama called little attention to this when he spoke of the violence in Chicago immediately after Newtown in the same breath as what happened there. Is the new conversation about gun control relevant to the South Bronx, in your opinion?
Yeah, I agree with Obama in the sense that when violence is committed in the inner city, it's almost like taken for granted. And it's only when violence occurs in spaces that are considered sacred, you know, that's when the country starts to pay attention. That's when we start lobbying for new laws. That's when we want to take measures. And so I think, yeah, it's really important to sort of, you know, make some serious moves in terms of, you know, reducing gun availability.
And
because it will affect the inner cities.
We have to leave it there with Randall Contreras, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Cal State Fullerton. His new book is The Stick Up Kids, Race, Drugs, Violence, and the American Dream. Thanks a lot for talking with us about the past and the present of New York.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.